This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Daniel Pinkwater, is a prolific writer of children's books. His latest, The Artsy Smartsy Club, comes out in May. His voice may be familiar to you from his commentaries on NPR's All Things Considered and on Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. He also wrote and narrated a very funny satire of NPR called A Scugiazzi Christmas. It was loosely based on the story A Christmas Carol and starred Kartok's Maliazzi brothers. Tom and Ray Maliazzi have described Pinkwater by saying, "Pinkwater is nuts." In People magazine, Pinkwater was described as, quote, "one part Marx brother and one part cracked social satirist, with a particle of werewolf thrown in," unquote. Terry spoke with Pinkwater last summer about his book, Looking for Bobowitz, which, like many of his books, is illustrated by his wife, Jill Pinkwater. Here's how the book starts.
On Friday, I had my last day at Happy Valley Elementary School. On Saturday, the moving truck came and took all our stuff to Hoboken, New Jersey, and we left our house in Happy Valley forever. On Sunday, our first day in the new house, the temperature was 100 degrees Fahrenheit, the beginning of the hottest heat wave ever recorded in Hoboken in the month of June for 120 years. 120 years ago is when our Hoboken house had been built. This is what my parents did. They gave up a modern house in Happy Valley, New Jersey, a house with a front yard, a backyard, and trees, on a street with similar houses and similar trees, to move to a brick house with no front yard, practically no backyard, and no trees, on a street with guys sitting on the steps drinking cans of beer and spitting on the sidewalk, and cars and buses running right past our door, and the Hoboken house was in rotten condition and cost three times as much as we got for our Happy Valley house. My parents said we were going to fix up the house and have an urban lifestyle. This is what an urban lifestyle is. My bike was stolen the first hour we were in town, and it was 100 degrees Fahrenheit. My mother said she didn't want me growing up in a suburb. She said life was real in cities. I went upstairs to sit in my crummy 120-year-old room.
Yes, a lot of us are familiar with that particular brand of urban lifestyle.
Yes.
But what are some of the cool things your character ends up finding in the city?
Well, first of all, he finds friends, which is actually what the book is about. He finds friends. It happens this kid, whose nickname is Nick, it has a collection of old, does anyone remember Classics Comics? Do you remember
them? Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Great things to learn to read with, you know, and it's basically, for those who don't know, regular comic books looking like comic books. They cost a dime, color comics, 52 pages, two staples, but the stories were Treasure Island and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, etc., etc. So he's got a stash of them. They're out of print now. You can't get them. Or you, maybe you can get him. He's got his father's old Classics comics, and they're his pride and joy. And it turns out the two kids who live in the apartment house next door also are into Classics comics, and that's the beginning of the friendship.
And he finds a pirate radio station also.
There's a pirate radio station in Hoboken, and it's a guy who plays old cowboy songs and blues and hillbilly music, all 78s. And he's operating from, here's where I mix historic fact and fiction, he's operating from the house in which Guglielmo Marconi lived, which really exists. He really lived there in Hoboken, the guy who invented radio. So the kids are into literature via the Classics comics and learning about American music via the pirate radio station. And that's as much as I care to say about that.
Okay.
Read the book.
Is childhood a place you'd like to return to? Like, when you look back on childhood, was that a good time or a bad time?
It was good and bad. It's like life. You know, people ask me if I like children, and I say, you know, is that a case-by-case basis? What I do is, I like to revisit my childhood. It seems to have a healing effect on me. And I like to write books that I would have loved to have at various ages. And my oversimplified way of describing this that I describe from time to time is, you're seven, and then you're eight. The seven-year-old isn't gone. The seven-year-old is still there intact. The eight-year-old is there when you're nine, ad infinitum, until you croak. So all of us carry within us our different aged selves. So it's not like I go back and write about my life, but I will start to get a clear sense of a moment. You know, it'll be tactile, it'll be sensory. You know, I'll smell things, I'll see dust motes in a sunbeam. It'll take me back to the back room in my parents' apartment in Chicago when I was, you know, 3 or something like that. And I'll get very in touch, and I get better and better at it through the years of going back to that kid who's still there, who was me. And then, you know, in some way, the book is created for that kid. And my theory being that there'll be other kids who have similar enough taste that they'll get it too.
Why do you think you get better at returning to memories from your childhood?
Practice. You know, it's like, I guess I haven't been psychoanalyzed because, one, I couldn't afford it, and other reasons too. But I imagine after a while...
You don't want to know, do you?
You sort of... I don't want anyone else to have anything to say about it. Uh-huh. I know plenty good because of my profession. I'm back there a lot, you know, and there's no end to the intercourse between your child self and your adult self. It never stops, and it motivates and conditions so many things we think and do as adults.
In speaking of your childhood, I was wondering, were you close with your parents?
Well, they were my parents. I was close to them. Close and frightened.
Frightened.
Listen, when you got a father who talks like this, doesn't matter what he's saying, and pointing with the finger, comes from Europe, you should be frightened.
Was he...
He was a gangster.
He was a gangster?
Well, he was a tough guy.
What did he do?
I don't know what he did. He wouldn't tell us, but I'll tell you this. In his office, in his dirty, messy office, he had a desk, and sometimes he'd let me come down. I'd sit while he made phone calls and hollered at people. I'd play with the things in his desk, which included 2 blackjacks. You know what is it, a blackjack, Terry?
Oh, yeah.
A sap? It's leather. It's plated leather. It's got a lead weight at one end, and it's sort of flexible. And there was a black one and a brown one. And I said, Daddy, what are these?
Those is blackjacks, sonny.
I said, how come you got 2, one black and one brown? I said,
the black one is with the gray suit, and the brown one is with the blue suit.
So he did give me a sense of style, I feel.
Well, that's really funny. I guess you never met any of the people he used it on.
I met his friends and colleagues. He might have used the blackjacks on them as well. They were like that. His own brother used to hire a truck periodically at night and back it up to my father's store and take everything out and sell it.
Wow. Huh. So what did
they did that in the old country. It was a traditional occupation. I should say, there's great stories by Isaac Babel. Do you know those? Benya Crick, the gangster in Odessa?
I don't.
Wonderful, wonderful. One of the great stylists, one of the great short story writers of the 20th century was this guy, Isaac Babel. And he wrote, the collections are called Red Cavalry, I think. But he has a character called Benya Crick. And this is precisely how it was, because I heard the same stories from relatives. Insufficient employment in the ghetto, okay? Young Jewish men with nothing else to do would abstract things from delivery carts. Then they would write a formal business letter to the consignee saying, Reb so-and-so, by a series of circumstances not worth going into our hands has come a parcel belonging to you, we believe, which you may redeem at a set rate or expect a disappointment in your family life.
So,
and it was all done like that. And in fact, the name of the story is how it was done in Odessa. And I'm sitting in the funeral cortege, my father's funeral, and a wild cousin is telling me the same story in terms of my father's occupation on the other side.
So what did your father tell you about the business he was in?
Nothing. Now, he had a business, and in fact, he was scrupulously honest according to his lights. He was the kind of guy who'd come back a year later to give you the quarter that he owed you. And it's maybe because, and there's a story that upon arriving in this country, and I remember him saying to us, I asked him, what was your first impression of New York when you finally hit land? And he said, the size of the policeman, the average size of the New York City cop impressed him.
Was he mean to you?
He was not mean. He was cruel. There's a difference.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. In what ways was he cruel to you?
He was basically he's an old European father, so there was a lot of roaring and striking.
And did he think that that was good for you in the long run, or was he just sadistic?
He wasn't sadistic. He was more psychotic. We had a good relationship, I have to say. I enjoyed him. He enjoyed me. But he was nobody to mess with either.
Now, tell us something about your mother.
She was an awful person in her way, but she was pretty much quiet.
An awful person in her way.
Yeah.
What was so awful?
She's not worth talking about. She
really was awful.
I can't say I liked her at all.
Right. Was she mean to you?
She was mean in her way. She was. I would much rather have a bombastic, fisticuffs yelling father than. I don't want to talk about my mother. She was awful. I have a hard time writing sympathetic mothers, but I force myself.
Does that stand in the way?
Yes, sometimes it does. You know, I mean, you're in a position to get a couple of licks in, but then she's so pathetic that it's not that hard to forget about her.
Now, does that make it harder for you to make these kind of memory trips back to childhood at all?
No, the thing is, you know, it was a very chaotic childhood. My parents would disappear and go to nightclubs almost every night during the war. And they would always have a picture taken. And I would be awakened from sleep by my mother smelling of cigarettes and wearing a mink coat, cigarettes and perfume, giving me a hug at 3 a.m. And they would bring me as a souvenir a photo taken in the restaurant of all these people, the men with broken noses, you know, and the women, you know, dripping with pearls and furs. And they were out, they were, I think, heavily influenced by Nick and Nora Charles. And there was all manner of strange things going on. There was a couple who lived in the back room of one of these long, enormous Chicago apartments that goes on forever. In the back room lived a Polish anthropologist and her husband, who was a political radical. And the Polish anthropologist was under contract to the War Department to research psychological warfare versus Japan. So to sort of get into the Japanese ethos, she was cooking a Polish person's idea of Japanese food. She did all the cooking. So I was raised on a bizarre kind of Japanese-Polish cuisine, all manner of stuff. And I had a much older brother and sister who my mother had thrown in an orphanage at one point before she married my father. They'd been pulled out. They were living there. They kind of raised me. It was quite an interesting setup. I had a terribly good time. The fact that my parents were not necessarily good parents, and in other circumstances, I would have been taken away from them probably, didn't really signify too much. My half brother and half sister, as my sister puts it, had learned human values in the orphanage, and they were raising me, and it was such an interesting world. It was such an interesting neighborhood. The kids in the backyards. Classics comics were playing games based on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Mysterious Island and so forth. I had a rich childhood, and I was discovering cultural treasures all the time.
Daniel Pinkwater speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to our interview with Daniel Pinkwater. His latest book, the third installment of the Hoboken Chicken Stories, is called The Artsy Smartsy Club and will be published next month.
Now, I want to ask you a question about the name of a character in your new book, Looking for Bobowitz.
Yes.
And his name is Sean, and depending on how you want to read the last name, it's either Ferguson or Fergesson. It's F-E-R-G-E-S-S-I-N.
Yes, he's a recurring character in other books.
Now, that's. Do you mean that as the Yiddish word forgotten or forgetting, forgotten?
There's an earlier book, and this, it pains me to say, my first novel, Lizard Music, is the best book I ever wrote. Imagine my chagrin, 99 books later, still trying to match it. But that can happen, and it happened to me, and as you see, I'm taking it with good grace. And in it, there's a character named Shane Ferguson. And that, of course, is the classic joke, which is on the golf course or in the clubhouse, someone is paid. Shane Ferguson, this very Yiddish man, old man, goes to take the call. And when he comes back, his golfing partner says, your name is Shane Ferguson? We weren't introduced. He says, yes, that's my name is Shane Ferguson. And he says, this, you seem like an Eastern European Jewish person. He says, that's right, I am. So Shane, how do you? He says, well, when they asked me my name at Ellis Island, I was so confused. I said, Shane Ferguson, which means I have already forgotten. So this is an internal in-joke. There's all kinds of stuff, like raisins in the rice pudding in all my books, referring to things which are real, things which are not real but might be, and things which readers will recognize from other books. I can't help it. It's extra kicks. I just put them in. It doesn't hurt if you don't get them, but if you do get them, it just makes the rice pudding that much more enjoyable.
Now, you said that your first book was your best book.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
What was it about?
Lizard Music is about a kid whose parents take off on a trip and leave him in the care of his older sister, who takes off on a trip of her own, which leaves him all by himself and free to begin exploring. And it's the first book in which the suburban kid is magnetically drawn into the old city to look around and find things. And he's on a particular quest because he's discovered that at night, after the TV station goes off the air, it comes back on the air, and there are lizards, actual lizards, playing jazz. And he wants to find out more about it, and that leads him into the city, and he meets various people, and he has quite an adventure, and it's just such a perfect book. I didn't know that I'd ever be allowed to write another one, and I just hit the notes perfectly.
What a great fantasy.
It's a great book. It's a great book. It's considered a classic. It'll probably live after I do, and it should. And all my other stuff, I'm getting better. I'm making progress. I have that to try and match. I don't think I've matched it yet. This one doesn't. Looking for Bobowitz.
You used to illustrate your book, so I assume you illustrated the first one.
I started out to be an artist. I went to New York to crack the art world. And it took years for me to realize that this wasn't a good idea. And I started as an illustrator. I started wanting to be an illustrator and wound up illustrating my own text because I didn't have a text to illustrate. Got more interested in writing. I went to art school. I have a degree. I don't like to draw. It makes me nervous. I like to write. It's completely pleasurable. Some people think that that's one of the many reasons why I shouldn't be taken seriously, because you're supposed to suffer. I don't. But I suffered plenty doing illustrations. My wife is the daughter of a painter, my wife Jill. And this, her mother is on the order of mine, and said to her two talented daughters, you may not be artists. One day she walked into my office, and I was sitting doing what I do, which is to say, staring off into the middle distance, and it's impossible to tell if I'm working or thinking or if I've died. So she, to see what was the case, she picked up a folder and said, what's this? You see? And I said, the story is supposed to be illustrated. And she said, how's about I do it? I said, fine, take a sketchbook, go illustrate, make drawings. And she came back in an hour with sketches, and they were just so wonderful that I called up the editor and said, look, this may seem off the wall to you, but instead of me illustrating the book, would you consider letting my wife try to? And she said, wonderful idea. Yes, we'll have Jill do it. We'll write up a different contract for her. Never having seen any of her work, it could only tell me how they felt about mine. And the fact is, she draws the way I would draw if I could really draw. I love her stuff. I just love it. And so I stopped illustrating because hers is so interesting and exciting, and it's such fun to see what she comes up with. She was writing some pretty good novels, but I'm not sure she'll be writing anymore because I won't give her the time. I keep giving her projects of mine to do.
How long have you been married?
30-odd years or forever, whichever comes first.
That's a good track record.
Yes, especially since we got married 6 weeks after the day we met.
Wow.
And decided to get married 2 days after the day we met. And it's been clicking along ever since in its way.
Huh. Now, you don't have children.
No.
It too personal to ask whether that's intentional?
Who knows if it's intentional or ordained, but it works out that we don't have children, which gives us many kinds of freedom to do some things that we are able to do, not better than, but different than if you had children to worry about.
Did you want to be a father?
I have never felt a strong desire to be a father.
Some people might be surprised to hear that. Since you write for children, they might assume that, you know, it would be like your big goal in life to be a father.
No, it's my big goal in life to write for children.
Right. Well, Daniel Pinkwater, it was really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was really great to talk with you.
Daniel Pinkwater speaking last year with Terry Gross. The follow-up installment to his children's book, Looking for Bobowitz, will be published next month. It's called The Artsy Smartsy Club. And he has a novel coming out next month as well, called The Education of Robert Nifkin. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.